the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on the program today is Mitch Anthony. You know how we discuss retirement here on the program, how to get ready for it, the things you have to do to plan. Now I have one question. What happens if retirement is passé? That seems to be Mitch Anthony's idea for the future. But as far as our program today, we are going to focus on three generations, millennials, Gen X, and baby boomers. But today, we're going to show you how easy it is to become a millionaire. Making savings and compound interest with time work for you to make you a millionaire. After all, Warren Buffett started with just $10,000, and now he is worth $56 billion. So if you're 25, 45, 55, or 65, you're going to want to listen to today's show, because becoming a millionaire is easier than you think, and it doesn't require a lottery ticket. With today's low interest rate environment, you're going to need $1 million just to retire.
Isn't there a show out there, John, Who Wants to Become a Millionaire?
Yep.
I thought there was a reality TV show.
There's one of those shows out there.
Is there?
Yep.
And they advocate buying lottery tickets?
No. They advocate answering an entire series of very silly questions. I mean, some of them are worthwhile, but others you go, just, I wouldn't know the answer to that one. Who'd want to know the answer to that question?
And if you did know the answer, what does that say about you? Well, anyway, one thing that we're going to be talking about today, and something that we've been finding in our practice over the years, John, we're seeing more and more individuals are postponing retirement, which is something I'll be talking with Mr. Anthony, who believes that retirement is sort of passé. You see a lot of articles written about this. A lot of individuals are choosing to work part-time in retirement to supplement their income. And they're finding, which is one of the reasons we're talking about $1 million, the assets they accumulated just simply aren't enough to get them through retirement. In some of the worst cases, you find an individual midway through retirement, either they're moving, going back to work, or having to downsize, in some cases, in the more extreme cases, moving back with the kids.
Well, never fear. The good news here is that with proper planning, most of these issues can be resolved. But like health issues, you do need to catch problems early. As a matter of fact, if you're good at it, you'll prevent the problems. And you want to be in a position so that problems can actually be fixed, that you can write the course. So let's start with a couple, young couple, age 25, and see how they can proceed to full retirement at age 67, which when you're 25, seems like a long way away. When you're 67, you ask, where did all that go?
You know, the real true story behind great wealth is compound interest in time. That's how you got a guy like Warren Buffett. And I'm going to share with you a couple case studies. One was in the Wall Street Journal today about a guy that was a janitor. And when he died at age 92, John, they found $8 million in his estate. Now, if you're young, starting out, or if you're listening to this program, you have grandchildren or your own children who are 25, pay close attention to what I'm going to tell you, because this is so doable. It is almost like it's nothing to accumulate $1 million. Now, if you're age 25, full retirement age for Social Security right now is 67. They may change that, but right now, if you're 25, full retirement age 67, that's basically 42 years. Now, let's assume your goal at age 67 is to accumulate $1 million. Here is a very powerful point. Now, what I did is took a person age 25, and I took two rates of return, 10%, 8%, and actually even got to 6%. But I think over longer term, over 100 years, and especially over 40 years, those returns are likely to be much higher, because you'll take in a bear market, a bull market, and you'll take a full spectrum in cycle. Looking back over the last 50 years, the returns have been over 10%. So I started with the 10% figure. Here's the number. At age 25, you only need to put away $155 a month at a 10% return, and you will have $1 million when you retire. An 8% return, well, you're going to have to put away a few bucks more. You're going to have to put in roughly about $274 a month And of course, a 6% return would be 473. But as you can see there, John, at a 10% return over a 42-year period, that's only $155.
So as you're illustrating here, depending on what kind of returns you get, you really only need to save as little as $155 to $270. Now, most couples, even at that age, say age 25, just by giving up one night out a month, could do that. So not talking unrealistically here. This is pretty simple, assuming that you have a fairly decent income when you start out.
Yeah. And John, the numbers are actually less than the numbers I just quoted, because that doesn't take into account today employer contributions such as matching contributions to 401k plans, nor does it take into account the amount of tax savings. That $155 that you put into a plan, that's deductible on your tax return. So you're going to save some tax savings on that amount, not to mention, you know, think about what happens when your employer matches your contribution, as many employers do today. So the numbers are reduced dramatically and much, much more doable than the numbers I've given you.
Okay, well, most companies today, either small or large, have some kind of a savings or retirement program. A lot of them have popular plans such as the 401k, the 403b, or 457s. And as we know, contributions come at the top of income and are tax deductible. What do the numbers look like when you subtract tax savings and employer contributions from those monthly figures?
This is where it really gets fun, and it really shows you how doable this is. Now, assuming matching contributions, usually a lot of employers will match up to 6% contributions. So what I did, I took those same numbers, and I took that number that I gave were $155 and said, okay, half of that's going to come from the employer. So your half is only roughly about $78. And of that $78, I took a combined 30% tax bracket. It's even better if you're in a higher bracket. So subtracting one half of that contribution is made up by your employer. That's $78. Backing out 30% in tax savings, John, here's the number. $54 out of pocket with tax savings. And that's at a 10% return. Now we take the number at 8%. It's roughly $96. So that's probably what? One dinner or one night out on the town, a few lunches or lattes at Starbucks. So, you know, you add matching contributions, you can cut that number in half and then subtract 30% for taxes. I can't think of a young couple starting out today that can't afford $55 a month. It doesn't really take that much money to become a millionaire.
Yeah, and that's what it looks like if you start early, you know, but what if you wait now 10, 20, 30 years? Let's look at brackets here. Say they start preparing for retirement at age 35 and then 45 and 55. You have a shorter time frame for compounding your money. So I would imagine the monthly contribution numbers are going to get a bit larger.
You're right. I mean, the shorter the time frame that you have to compound, it's very simple mathematics. But what I did is I took age 35, age 45, and age 55, did the same thing. Divided the number in half, assuming your employer is going to match half of that. Let's say you have a 401k plan. I took out 30% for taxes. At age 35, the numbers jump up a bit. Now, this is the key time in compounding, because remember, at age 25, it was $55. Fast forward 10 years to age 35, that number jumps to $145 at a 10% return, $217 a month at 8%. Now, let's assume now it's only 22 years at retirement at age 45. Same sequence, 10% returns, 8% returns, employer matching contributions, and 30% tax savings. The number jumps to $408 a month, which is still doable at age 45, and assuming you're well into your career, and $526 with an 8% return. But here's where it really starts to get sticky. You wait to age 55 to try to do it. Even with tax savings and matching contributions, that number skyrockets to almost $1,364 a month at 10% returns. At 8%, that number jumps to over $1,500. So you can see at age 55, let's just take the 10% return and you'll see how this begins to magnify. At age 25, it's $55 a month. At age 35, it's $145, basically almost three times. At age 45, it's over $400 a month. At age 55, It almost becomes $1,400 a month. So you can see the numbers are still doable in the 30s and 40s. However, you start waiting till your 50s, the numbers become very difficult to make those numbers work out. That's when we end up usually doing triage on individual retirement plans because, you know, they get a late start, then maybe they spent too much money, they didn't save enough, didn't take advantage of tax deductions, employer contributions, or they overspent, maybe they spent too much on a child's education, weddings, bar mitzvahs, whatever it is, they didn't have a plan. Now, all of a sudden, they're 55, and in some cases, all of a sudden, they get laid off. I mean, think of how many people lost their job in the Great Recession, or at least one spouse lost their job. And so that's what you don't want to do. You want to start early. And if you're a grandparent listening to this, you know, really instill this into your grandchildren, or if you're a parent, instill this into your children. Because, I mean, I can't think of a couple, age 25, that can't afford to put away $55 out of pocket a month. That is a very doable number, and it remains doable well into your 40s.
But if you don't do that, then you wind up doing some kind of triage on the whole thing. Unfortunately, there's a simple fact of life. When you're age 25, Jim, I'm going to live forever. You don't think about an event 40 years away. By the time you get to your 30s, you're buying a home or trading up to bigger homes right now. By the time you get into your 40s, sometimes 50s, depending on when marriage occurs here, you're dealing with your kids' college, expenses related to that, weddings, bar mitzvahs. Well, I guess if we're going to be equal opportunity here, confirmations, quinceañeras, and we could list all of the different special events you're probably going to pay for. So unless you have a plan in place, usually you've got some financial constraints here, which causes financial stress. And sometimes, well, unfortunately, you know, the chief cause of marital difficulty is quite often a financial stress because things haven't been planned. And then when you're trying to set aside money for retirement in the midst of that, that gets to be a real problem. This could have all been planned and or avoided with some kind of a roadmap and a plan. So what do you do when you find a couple? They're in the late 50s, they're in their 60s, and all of a sudden they recognize, oh my, it's almost here, and they discover they can't retire, or worse off, they're retired, but having difficulty keep going. So they put retired in quotes.
You know, usually, John, I would say probably in about 90% of the time, we can fix the problem. However, you have to have a commitment to a plan. It may take several alternative scenarios. It may mean a move to another state. I've discussed several case studies here on the program where it was a major difference moving from a high expensive real estate place to live like California, moving to Arizona, some to Nevada, some to Florida, or even Texas. It may mean downsizing, selling the big home. It could mean, for example, delaying retirement age 66, 67, sometimes even later. It could involve part-time work, or in some cases, we've monetized a portion of a client's assets, which I'm going to share in today's case study. Here's the important point. You've got to become proactive. Stop procrastinating until you find yourself in a crisis mode. I'm involved in a very case study right now. A widow, age 85, had a stroke. Now, all of a sudden, she wants to live at home. She's incapable of taking care of herself. In addition to the kids helping mom out, now you're going to have home care, around-the-clock 24 care, an additional $5,000 or $6,000 a month. There's another $60,000 to $70,000 a year nobody planned for. You don't want to find yourself in that kind of situation. It's never too late to have a plan, and there's always an alternative. I've yet to find a case, rarely do I find a case where we can't figure out some means. It may be not the ideal choice, sometimes moving to another state, maybe moving to an area where housing's cheaper, maybe delaying retirement, working part-time. There's always an answer, but it begins with a commitment and begins with a plan. And you've got to stop procrastinating. You don't want to find yourself in a situation that we're dealing with now, with an 85-year-old widow who has a stroke, is now incapable of taking care of herself, and now there's an added burden of $60,000 to $70,000 a year.
Let me bring up an issue that many retirees find themselves under the new normal, as a matter of fact, where banks pay nothing in terms of interest. I mean, cash is paying zero on money market funds, and now bonds barely pay what money market funds do. Experts have cited that 70% of Americans have no retirement plan. So What do you do when a couple finds themselves with a retirement they didn't expect? We've had two bear markets in stocks, a bear market in real estate, and interest rates that have dropped over 90% and look to remain there for a long time. So now, this has been a rather big upset from what they originally planned on. What do they do here?
You know, John, once again, it begins with a plan and a budget. And then what you really try to do in these cases, and especially when we're doing triage, is you work with the clients and you look at alternatives. Because after all, if it's going to work, it's got to be the client's plan. It may involve selling the big house. Oftentimes, it's moving to another state because of the cost of living and lower taxes. Everything from income taxes to property taxes to sales taxes. Other means, various ways to leverage Social Security benefits, which we talk a lot about here on the program. Sometimes it's part-time work or delaying retirement for both spouses or one of the spouses. It may involve creating a steady stream of income that's predictable. In other words, creating your own pension plan. Some cases, rebalancing the portfolio to meet the objectives. And, you know, here's something I want to share with you, because there was a story in this last week's Wall Street Journal, and it was called A Route to an $8 Million Portfolio Started with Frugal Living. And this is the case of Ronald Reed, who started out his career pumping gas at a gas station and then ended up becoming a maintenance worker or janitor at JCPenney's. So, obviously, pumping gas at a gas station or a janitor at a JCPenney store is not a big buck occupation. When Mr. Reed died, he recently passed away at age 92, everybody knew that he was involved in the stock market. What they didn't know was the extent of his skill and frugality. When he passed away, his total portfolio was worth $8 million. That's right. That's not a mistake. A janitor, a guy that pumped gas, had an $8 million portfolio. He was diversified, did his own research, invested in sectors like utility companies, healthcare, telecom, consumer products. He avoided technology. Does this sound familiar? He owned railroads. How about Warren Buffett? Same kind of companies Warren Buffett invested in. Consumer product companies, utility companies, energy, healthcare, telecom, never touched a technology stock. And what he would do, good times, bad times, as the dividends came in, plowed it back in the market. In bear markets, he bought more stocks, more shares of his favorite companies. I mean, he owned such blue chip stalwarts like Procter & Gamble, General Electric, Dow Chemical, J.M. Smucker, CVS Health, Johnson & Johnson. Here was a great story, too. They talked about he bought 39 shares of Pacific Gas and Electric on January 13th, 1959. They must have had his confirmation ticket. So he bought 39 shares. The shares were worth about $2,380 when he bought them. At his death, there were 578 shares worth $26,000. almost a tenfold increase. And there's some more stories I want to share with you, because this isn't kind of like, oh, this is one of those guys that won the lottery, rare event. This is from humble givers. Jack McDonald clipped coupons and loved searching for the best deals, all while quietly and wisely investing his millions in the stock market. Close family members know he was wealthy, but others were stunned when they learned about his fortune. When he died in 2013, he left $188 million to Seattle Children's Hospital, the University of the Washington School of Law, and the Salvation Army. And he's not the only one. Ocella McCarty, raised by her grandmother and aunt, she began in washing. At a young age, she continued working as a washroom woman in her retirement at 86, loving what she did and appreciating the feeling of hard work done. Frugal living allowed her to amass a savings of $280,000. And this was a woman that just started out in the washroom. And so there are many, many stories. You have Eleanor Soverwin, who in her 90s, She started and left over $2 million. Bud Scala, ordinary job, left over $7 million. And I could go on and on and on, case study after case study, talking about people that lived frugally, invested. One of the things that I found fascinating in all of them, they all invested like Warren Buffett. They bought consumer staple companies, utilities, railroads, Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson, healthcare, things that people use on a daily basis. They held on to their shares. They kept them. They reinvested. When the markets went down, they didn't panic. They bought more. So, John, there are many cases like the ones I just cited, people with very humble backgrounds, a modest lifestyle and income, amassed large fortunes. And there's no better way to create wealth than, one, create your own business, the stock market, or real estate. In fact, I think of all of my wealthy clients, I have yet to meet a wealthy client that made their fortune by investing in money market funds or bank CDs. You know, you want to look at your city skyline, look at some of the tallest buildings in your own city. They're banks and insurance companies. What do you think they're doing? They're taking your money, as they are now, paying you next to nothing for it. They're investing in the market. They're investing in real estate. They're investing in businesses. I mean, you have people like Warren Buffett that says you ought to have 90% in stocks and 10% in bonds. You'll have more income. So here's a story. And John, we could do a whole show talking about, there were like 30, 40 stories that I discovered like this when I was doing research, because I remember there was a librarian. She lived in a modest co-op in New York City. And when she passed away in her 90s, once again, she was a librarian, go down to the city library, research stocks and Value Line. She left a fortune of $28 million. Very simple lifestyle, investing in the market long term, built a fortune.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I actually hear a movie script in here. Can't you imagine a movie where you have a janitor in some business and he comes to own the whole business, but nobody knows who the majority shareholder is? You know, and wouldn't it be a great
anybody
plot?
In Hollywood listening?
Yeah, exactly. That would be a terrific plot. And of course, he knows everything that's going on. And most of the big schmucky mucks in the business would despise him, you know, as being a lowly janitor, blah, blah, blah.
Turns out he owns the company.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Hudsucker Proxy, you know, movies like that. Anyway, you know, I'm always fascinated at stories we hear at the gym, talking to people at the gym about what they're doing with interest rates at zero, in some cases negative. Many people insist on investing for returns that are below the inflation rate or even worse after taxes. And one gentleman actually told me he does that because he can sleep better at night. His money, quote unquote, is all there, not recognizing that you're actually losing the buying power of that money.
You know, it always fascinates me, and I've told this story because people say, what about another bear market? I mean, every one of these people that we just talked about, the story about Mr. Ronald Reed that had the $8 million, which was a story in last week's Wall Street Journal. John, they held on to their quality stocks. They never lost a dividend during the downturn. And during the downturn, as the cash flow came in from their dividends, they bought more shares of their favorite companies. And I told the story, and I've repeated this, but I want to illustrate a point here. And that was, we did a case study where, let's say you had walked into my office January 1st, 2008, we put 50% of your portfolio in bonds, 40% in stocks, and let's say 10% in cash. By March 9th of 2009, your stock portfolio would have been down 30%. Your bond portfolio would have been up 10%. Your cash would have been even. In the worst financial panic since the Great Depression, you would have been down 7%. And oh, by the way, your income actually went up 7 or 8% that year. Because I often talk about Coca-Cola. A lot of people amassed great fortunes during the Great Depression by a bank trust officer out of Florida that bought Coca-Cola stock for many of his clients. In fact, on, what was it, the 100th anniversary of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Wall Street Journal did a movie, a documentary on the stock market, a 100-year history. And they featured this couple at the beginning of the story. They were sitting around a table. You know, they were in their 80s. And they talked about each decade of the market. By the end of the video, they show this couple, they own this magnificent horse ranch in Kentucky. They didn't hint that they were worth billions, but they were worth hundreds and hundreds of millions just off Coca-Cola. We've talked about the dividend aristocrats here on the program, companies that have increased their dividends consecutively for 25 years, Coca-Cola being one of them. And one of the common themes that you see from all these guys. Now, Warren Buffett didn't come from humble beginnings. His dad was a stockbroker and a senator. But Warren Buffett turned $10,000 in the 50s into $56 billion. John, I can think of my own grandfather. My grandfather came over in the 30s to avoid what was happening in Germany and in Europe during that period of time. He came over here. He didn't even have a high school education. Went to work for Standard Oil of Indiana. And when he passed away, and my grandmother passed away, that stock split off and became different companies, but became seven figures for three of his children. So, you know, you take a lot of these stories that you hear about, for example, Ronald Reed and his $8 million and others. They come from humble beginnings. They had a common theme. They invested in high quality blue chip stocks. They invested for the long run, let their money compound. As they grew wealthier, they actually even paid less taxes.
Now, I understand that you are going to do a series of workshops this summer.
Yeah, I'm quite excited about this. We've had a lot of requests for this because, you know, obviously with tax laws changing, things have become more complex. So we're going to be doing two workshops, small workshops, only 14, 15 people. We're going to be doing two a month. We're going to be doing them one on pre-retirement, one on Social Security, another one on advanced tax planning, advanced estate planning, and also college planning. And if you're grandparents, you're going to hear a little bit of a story in this week's case study. Pay close attention because there's so many things that you could be doing for your grandchildren. The same compounding story that we talked about in this case of Ronald Reed and others that have amassed these fortunes. Think about dollar cost averaging in a good stock mutual fund for your grandchildren when they're born. Think of what they're going to have over two decades when they start college. They may be driving a Mercedes to college if you start out early enough. So yeah, we're quite excited about this. We're going to be doing a series of workshops, and we're going to be bringing experts into the field, from estate planning attorneys to experts on Social Security, because the real tragedy in all of this is 70% of Americans have no retirement plan. That's the real tragedy here.
Now it's time for our real life case study. As always, the case studies are actual events or things which have occurred, but the names of the people involved have been changed so their privacy is protected. So our couple this week, Jim?
Our couple this week is the case of Bill and Jan Smith. Bill retired earlier. By the time we met him, he was age 66, retired. His wife was within just retirement. She was getting ready to retire at age 58. And when we met them, she was still having a salary of $80,000. So basically, they were living off Jan's salary of $80,000 a year as a school teacher, and they were living off Bill's income of Social Security, which was roughly about $1,450 a month. That was translated into $17,400. But here's the problem. Jan was getting ready to retire, and given the years of service with the school district, she would get 66% of her teacher's salary of $80,000 a year. That was $54,120. So their total income, John, was $71,520. Here's the problem. Their annual budget was $105,000. So we had almost a $34,000 shortfall when Jan retired. And part of that budget, what we like to do when we look at a person's expenses, what we try to do is break it down into like essentials. What does it cost you to live? Your house payment, utilities, medical insurance, all the things that you have that are the basics of life. So their essential budget was roughly about $90,000 a year. The things that they love, playing golf, that was about $10,000 a year with a little travel. You know, most of the travel they did is with their own motorhome locally around the country. So that was inexpensive. And the want-to-haves is they wanted to put $5,000 a year into their grandchildren's college education program. And we'll come back to that later on because we modified this after 2 years of in the plan, because basically they were just putting it into a bank CD account at the bank. And the reason for that was Bill's experience when he first retired. He put his money, rolled it into the stock market in 2006. And of course, you know what happened in the next couple of years. But here's the problem. The budget was $105,000. When Jan quit, the income was only $71,500. They were okay as long as Jan worked and there was Social Security and some interest income that they were earning off their investments.
All right. So Jan had a pension and Bill had Social Security, which for many people is a lot better than the norm. What about asset here?
Part of the problem here is they had a home, basically a condominium on a golf course, $450,000. Bill's IRA was worth about $650,000. That used to be an $800,000 IRA when he retired, but the losses during the market downturn. So it was basically invested in cash, in CDs at the bank, in various money market funds, because very, very frightened about the stock market. Jan had a 403b plan. That's in the education market. It's equivalent almost of a 401k program. And they had roughly about $40,000 in savings on the bank on top of that that they used in liquid cash in their checking account, which wasn't the best return. So total investment assets were roughly about $990,000. But here's the problem. Total assets were $1,440,000 if I included the home, but we had liabilities, a mortgage of $300,000, so their real net worth was $1,140,000. One of the problems, and here's a major issue that I'm sure a lot of couples listening to this will relate to. Bill had cardiovascular disease, had a heart attack, had a couple stents. He was on a medication to reduce his cholesterol. The other difference was age difference. Not only did Jan's family have longevity with her mother still living, but there was an 8-year difference between Jan and Bill, not to mention longevity on Jan's side and cardiovascular disease on Bill's side. So there was an age difference. There was a health difference. Their main concerns were outliving assets. And of course, Bill's market fears, unfortunately, when Bill retired, rolled over his 401k, as many individuals do, into an IRA. Now think back to 2006, real estate prices were going up. The stock market was going up each year. But that nagging central bank was raising interest rates. And Bill did not see what was coming ahead of him in the stock market, and he lost quite a bit of money. I mean, $150,000. So he was very fearful about going back into the stock market when we met him. Now, going back to where we had $90,000 of essential expenses, $10,000 in must-haves. That was the vacations, golf, $5,000 that they really wanted to fund in their grandchildren's education. Against that, we had Bill's Social Security of $17,400, and of course, Jan's teacher's pension of $54,000. Now, what we did is we had to create stability. You can't take somebody that basically lost a lot of money in the stock market and put them all into stocks. It's just not going to work. So what we did is we took about $500,000 of the $650,000 that Bill had in his pension. We did a laddered bond portfolio at 4%. That created $20,000 of income. And then we put $150,000 in dividend-paying stocks at 3%. I'm talking about the Coca-Colas, the Procter & Gambles, the Exxons. Now, what we did here was a little different. Given the 8-year time span difference between Bill and Jan, given Bill's health issues, what we did is we took $230,000 of Jan's 403b and we did a 10-year certain annuity that would produce $2,000 a month or $24,000 a year. So that would almost equate back to what she was earning when she was working. That was $24,000 that would be guaranteed for 10 years, meaning if Jan died before 10 years, those payments would continue to Bill or the estate to their children. But as long as Jan lived, if she lived to be 90-something like her mother, that $2,000 a month would be coming in. So out of the $300,000 of her 403b plan, We put $230,000 for a single life annuity. Bill loved the idea because it created certainty along with the bond portfolio. And then we took about $70,000 and put it into stocks. So total investment income now was $50,600. Total income now with the pension was $71,520 and roughly a little over $50,000 investment income. So we had $122,000 of total income against a budget of $105,000. So we now had surplus of $17,000 a year. But we did a couple other things as well. One of the things is that Jan really stressed they loved their condo on the golf course. They didn't want to move. And given the age difference, Jan would feel that, for example, if something happened to Bill, she wanted to be able to stay there. So we refinanced the house on a 15-year mortgage. So in 15 years, at age 75, that house would be free and clear. The one thing they did do is they did have long-term care insurance. That was something that they had taken out earlier. So Bill's health, long-term care insurance would take care of that. On the inflation and health care, we had dividend growth investments. And then also that 15-year mortgage at close to 3% at the time, that would allow Jan to stay in the house. It would be free and clear. And then we handled the market fears with the laddered bond portfolio. And then also the drop in income that Jan had when she retired because she only got 66% of her salary. We made that up with the monthly annuity.
Okay, well, Bill had laddered bonds and annuities, and those things are pretty steady and guaranteed. But now he had stocks. How did he handle those things during the stock market crisis?
Well, this case we actually did in 2013. I think we did it in the spring. And of course, we all know what happened in May of 2013. That was when Bernanke went on Capitol Hill and announced the taper, or what we called the taper tantrum. And that's when interest rates doubled. So his bond market got hit. Secondly, on top of that, the stock market went down. So I got a phone call. They came in. And you could just see in his eyes, I'm going to go through this again. And you remember what everybody was talking about back then. So I just said, hold on. Our LEIs are ticking up. Our stress indicator doesn't indicate any kind of financial crisis. We will get through this. And sure enough, the stock market came back in 2013. The stock market was up over 30%. Now, the bond market, his bonds, lost a little bit of their value in 2013 because remember, the long bond went from 1.6 to almost 3%. But I said, look, Bill, as long as we hold these bonds, your income is not going to change. That's guaranteed. And when they come due, you're going to get your principal back. What happened in 2014? Interest rates went down. The stock market went up. More money made in stocks, dividend increases, and the bonds came back and are now worth more than what he paid for them. So it was going through that a couple of times that gave him that confidence that, hey, even though the stocks are down, that doesn't mean your dividends stop. The dividends are actually increasing. Coca-Cola increased its dividend. Procter & Gamble increased its dividend. Exxon increased its dividend. And that gave him the confidence. And what we're doing now is we've modified the plan for his grandchildren because they give $5,000. They give $2,500 a piece. They're actually stepping that up. They're giving more now because of the excess income. We've picked a couple of good blue chip dividend mutual funds. And what they do is they just contribute a little money every single month and it goes into a mutual fund for their grandchildren. And I told them at this rate, by the time those grandchildren get to college, you know, assuming over, you know, a period of close to 15, 18 years, that's going to be a substantial sum of money by the time those grandchildren get to college. So once again, long-term investing, high-quality investing. But here was a case where we were able, through a little bit of creative thinking and alternatives, to solve a problem from a deficit to a surplus to stability.
And once again, another success story. Coming up next, Mitch Anthony. Retirement may be passé for some people. What does that mean when you're doing retirement planning? All of that upcoming on Lifetime Income at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his Lifetime Income Specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, for years, it was a dream. retire early, age 62, play golf, travel the world. And that was a dream that was in place for so many Americans for generation after generation. But times have changed. People are living longer. They're working longer. Joining me on the program is Mitch Anthony. Mitch, you believe that retirement is an unnatural phase of life that's run its course. In fact, you talk about we're at a tipping point on the issue of retirement. Explain that.
Well, yeah, we really are, Jim. First of all, a lot of people struggle with retirement. That's sort of what drew my attention to it, right? And the deeper I dug into the issue, the more I realized that retirement was sort of a social experiment. It was an industrial age invention that sort of has run its course, but we've hung on to it. And people have all sorts of challenges with it because of that. I call retirement an artificial finish line, Jim, because basic retirement policy is hinged to a number, your age. And a cultural, social, industrial expectation that when you reach 62 or 65, whatever that number may be, that this is what you're supposed to do. So that presupposes that all 62-year-olds are equal. I don't know if anybody would agree with that, right? And so people have varying degrees of energy, varying degrees of drive, varying degrees of motivation, varying degrees of interest and curiosity, and et cetera. And so how can we have a policy in place that says when you cross this line, this number, that you're done? I just don't buy into it. And so if you look at the history of retirement, it becomes pretty clear that it worked in the industrial age because people were trading physical capital for a paycheck. It was physical output. Physical energy was being expended to get paid. So it just made sense that a 62-year-old might be tired, and they replaced that 62-year-old in their industrial line with a 20-year-old, and the machinery resumes its efficiencies. But when we're no longer trading physical capital for our paycheck, but we're trading intellectual capital and experiential capital, the whole conversation changes, doesn't it?
Let's talk about that age 62, which was beginning Social Security benefits. Then it was age 65. Of course, they pushed that out a couple of years. Mitch, was that originally based on life expectancy? Because I know we've seen life expectancy tables expand. Was it life expectancy where we got that number?
They put the marker originally at 65 in 1935. And then realized after they did that the average life expectancy of American workers was 63 at the time. Think of that.
Mm.
So in a period of 75 years, the life expectancy has expanded by almost a third to about 84 years of age. And so the original design, and by the way, they ratcheted back the age of eligibility for Social Security in 1937 to 62 because of that. So think about it. The life expectancy was 63, and people retired at 62, or began retiring.
And so you lived a year, collected a check, and died.
Absolutely right. And when you look at it, you know, and it's not that long ago. I can remember, I live in Rochester, Minnesota, home of the Mayo Clinic, and we got an IBM facility. I can remember just 20-some years ago reading these actuary tables of IBM employees, the average pensioner collected like 26 checks. I was talking to a friend the other day. When he was growing up, his buddy's dad retired from the railroad, and one of the perks, this is crazy, one of the perks they gave retired railroad guys was their liquor of choice for life. Can you imagine?
No gold watch, but you got liquor, huh?
No gold watch. So this guy had a garage full of Jack Daniels. You suppose that was helping the pension liability for the railroad?
You betcha.
It's unbelievable. So, you know, people just weren't living that long. But now contrast that with today, where people may live 30, 35, 40 years in quote-unquote retirement.
You know, I know it's one thing that strained the system. And we had, along with this idea of retirement, we've had a whole industry built around it. Del Webb came in and started building retirement communities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Wall Street responded, and the government did too, in terms of pension-type programs, whether it was IRAs. But, you know, the world changed, Mitch, and you've seen this. A lot of companies, I can remember in my dad's era, you know, an individual went to work for a company, spent 25, 30 years, maybe got a Timex watch, and got something called a defined benefit pension plan where he knew exactly what he was going to have when he was retired.
That's right.
I don't know very many Fortune 500 companies that have defined benefit pension plans anymore.
No, they don't. Well, you know, we just had this happen at the Mayo Clinic, which is a leading healthcare institution, where they changed the defined benefit plan. So even in your nonprofit arena now, this is beginning to change in the 403B world. So look, here's the problem. Because they underestimated the liability of pensions, they are now reneging on those promises. I've always defined a pension as a promise that's good until it's not. And it seems like, you know, every year we read about companies that are pulling back and saying, no, we can't do that anymore.
Well, we're seeing it, as you mentioned, at the Mayo Clinic. You wonder how long it's going to be for the government. At one point in time, you went to work for the government, you made less money, but the idea was you had this nice, secure pension that was a defined benefit. Now we know that government wages, in many cases, exceed that of the private sector. And I know here in my own state of California, one of the real issues here, besides welfare liabilities, are pension liabilities for state workers.
Well, yeah, I think you probably have a more front row view of that issue playing out in California than anywhere else. You've got cities declaring bankruptcy over it. You know, I don't want to go down the political path, but we had really a political firestorm here in the Midwest with Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin saying, you guys have to live in the real world too, and made adjustments to the benefits of public employees, and it didn't go over well.
Well, sooner or later, that reality is going to be forced even in the governmental sector, as it's done in the retirement center. I want to talk about some of the implications of this, because one of the things that we're seeing in this world of 0% interest rates or financial repression, I mean, I use an illustration, Mitch, that gets the point across. If you wanted, let's say, $3,000 of monthly income in the year 2000, you wanted to be in something fairly conservative, bank CDs, or let's say I picked a 2-year treasury note. All it took was $540,000 in the year 2000. I could have got you $3,000 worth of income. Today, it would take over $8
million. That's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, so let's talk about the implications, because what we're starting to see, and I call doing triage on many of the retirement plans that we're dealing with now, where individuals thought that they were going to have a certain rate of return, whether it was coming from bank CDs, treasury bills, or even bond funds, they're finding themselves 5 or 6 years into their retirement, their income has dropped dramatically instead of gone up. They find themselves in a financial situation they didn't think they were going to be in when they retired. So is this one of the tipping point factors, not just the fact that companies are no longer offering that security that they once did with the defined benefit pension plan, but also with the issue of the returns on investments in the markets are also forcing people to look at retirement differently?
Well, yeah. I come at it from both the existential and the economic point of view, Jim. The topic here I'm going to go into is work itself. You can't have a conversation about retirement without talking about work, because what is it you're retiring from? And what I found in my research is that a lot of people actually end up missing aspects of work, and they get bored. How many bored retirees have you seen in your career, right?
Oh, a lot. I've had a lot of executives that retired early only to come back, or I've seen people that have sold their company and after 3 or 4 years of inactivity, they got bored out of their minds and went out and started another company.
And that's because work actually has benefits other than just economic. I'll get to the economic benefits. But the first discussion around work is, what benefits are there to work other than economic that help feed your life? And nobody's goal is to get enough money someday to become completely irrelevant, is it? Right? Some of us actually want to contribute to the world. And the traditional retirement vision is to go from being a contributor to a consumer. But what I find is the consumption lifestyle consumes people and they feel useless and aimless and worthless. And, you know, they get tired of it and they say, you know what, I'm going to do something. It's a new trend in our world. 60% of the people that retire this year are going to go back to work part time within 6 months. And then we get into what you're alluding to here, the economic aspects of this. I've always told people one of the scariest days of your economic life is the last day you cash a paycheck. And the reason that's one of the scariest days of your economic life is because from that day forward, the price of everything begins to matter. And the reason the price of everything begins to matter is because you now are on a static income and expenses will continue to rise over time. And that gap gets bigger and bigger between your income and the inflation rate. And that gap gets filled with anxiety. You've seen it over and over, haven't you?
Oh, I see it all the time. And I'll tell you one thing that also happens that is not planned for is you take a couple age 65, Mitch, as you well know, they could spend 25 years or a third of their life in retirement. in the numbers, our out-of-pocket expenses will end up being almost $250,000 out-of-pocket expenses. I have a case right now where a widow had a stroke, and all of a sudden now the family is dealing with, you know, live-in care that's going to be almost $5,000-$6,000 a month, you know, $72,000 a year. There's an expense that wasn't planned for.
Yeah, exactly right. So, I mean, at the end of the day, the economic benefit of work is obvious, isn't it? I mean, having more income. And people are beginning to realize this, and some people go back to work because they need the income, but others go back to work just for a margin of safety, or maybe they can help pay some health benefits. And, you know, myself personally, I love what I do, and age has nothing to do with it. And as long as it's relevant, I define work this way, Jim. It's an engagement that brings value to others and meaning to you, okay? That could be a volunteer engagement, or it could be an engagement for pay. But it's an engagement that brings value to others and meaning to me. So at what age should one no longer want to bring value to others and meaning to themselves? Work is part and parcel of life. Freud said the only two things that matter in life are love and work.
Well, you know, it not only gives meaning, but you talk about four trends that portend the end of retirement thinking as we know it. One, the evolving pursuit of fulfillment in our times. Two, the end of the paternalistic employer. Three, the advent of dismantling ageism. And four, distribution-driven Armageddon for financial services. I'd like you to address each one of those and explain to our audience the impact they have on retirement.
What we've learned about a life of leisure, a life of nothing but leisure, does not fulfill people. As one gerontological researcher at the Mayo Clinic put it to me, a life of total ease is two steps removed from a life of total disease. And people are interested in aging successfully and aging well. So a life of fulfillment, what people are finding is really found in a life of balance between vocation and vacation. It's not being all vocation for 40 years and all vacation for the next 30. It's finding a balance between vacation and vocation. And actually, it's vocation that brings meaning to vacation, right? You know, it's like the guy told me on the golf course. He said it was a lot more fun when it was a catharsis for my work. Now my golf has become my work and I'm not having as much fun. It makes sense, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Work gives meaning to leisure, and without work, leisure loses its meaning. And this is why there's a law of diminishing return on the life of leisure. People are saying, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I can't just play all the time. There are people moving out of those gated communities as well as moving in, right? And so it's that balance that people are looking for. We have a trend away from ageism. I mean, we have so many ageist policies in our world, especially in the working institutions, that someone that's 65 is looked at in a certain way. And of course, nobody's going to come out and say it, but we have ageism prevalent in the workplace today. There's no question about it. And that is being changed. And there are people that are breaking those rules and saying, you know what, you're not going to define me by that number. What really matters is how productive I am, how engaged I am, how competent I am. And I always say to people, if you want to know when to retire, I can tell you exactly when to retire. You retire on the expiration date of your intellectual capital, your relational capital, and your experiential capital. You retire when you no longer care. That's when you retire.
Well, you know, you can see this with ex-presidents who, you know, after they leave the office, a high-stress job, go on, you know, I don't care if it's President Jimmy Carter or President Clinton or President Bush, they're all doing things that are productive and contributing in one form or another, or getting involved in one form or another in life. And that is a trend that you talk about here. I want to talk about one that people that work in government should pay attention to, because the age of the paternalistic government pension plan is going to be coming to an end, in my opinion, in the next 10 years.
Well, we're almost there.
Yeah, I mean, Scott Walker was a harbinger of things to come.
Yeah, he really is. And, you know, he's a firebrand out here, but it's inevitable, isn't it? Because when you don't have enough money on the income side to pay the liability, something's got to give. And what's going to give is the liability. Because it's getting to the point where it's crippling states, it's crippling cities, it's crippling our system.
Let's talk about your comment on the distribution-driven Armageddon for financial services, because our industry is geared towards, you know, put your money in a 401k, put your money in a profit-sharing plan, gearing for retirement. Let's talk about how the financial industry is going to change, in my mind, for the betterment.
Yeah, well, the financial services industry, think about it, it's built around a concept called retirement, is it not? Right?
That's all you see on TV today is retirement commercials.
Yeah, retirement savings. Well, and the idea, and retirement is an anachronism in our times, and the idea, it's an ill-founded idea. It doesn't work in our system anymore. And the entire financial services industry is built around it. And so the entire financial services industry for decades has been telling people, save your money, grow your money, so someday you can retire. Well, what are they going to do when they retire? They're going to start drawing down assets. Well, how are most financial firms paid? They're paid on assets under management. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see where the trend's headed here. So, yeah, change is needed. And to me, the change starts with realizing that the idea, the concept of retirement that we built this thing around is flawed, and we need to reexamine it on an individual level, not just an institutional level, but an individual level. What's good for you, the individual? I encourage people to form their own IRA, individual retirement attitude. What do you want to do with the rest of your life? How are you going to invest the rest of your life? And then secondly, how are we going to pay for this plan? And for many people, quite frankly, it's going to mean people are going to be working longer. Some are going to do it because they want to. Some are going to do it because they need to.
You know, it's funny because I have seen a lot of individuals become better investors instead of retiring early, where, you know, you've seen this, Mitch. You retire early and you get the static pie chart. Oh, you're age 65. You need to have 65% of your portfolio in fixed income. How does that work when treasuries are at 2%?
Right.
Number one. And so because they're going to be drawing down their assets, they want the security, they make, I think, poor investment choices.
Yeah.
Where if you were working part-time or had some income, you could say, you know what, I can have some money in some blue chip stocks. And yeah, I can ride out the fluctuations because I'm not totally dependent on what's happening in the stock market for my means of support.
Yeah, I've always been amazed at who dreams up this vision of the future. So I'm going to get enough money so I can someday retire and sit and stare at the ticker on CNBC all day and worry myself to death. Right? And
yeah.
You know what I tell the people who are staring at their CNBC ticker? And you know as well as I do, there are millions of people doing that right now as we speak. And you know what I tell them? Invest in Procter & Gamble, and I'll tell you why. Because they make Pepto-Bismol, and you're drinking it by the bottle.
Well, you know, I had a situation. I had a doctor, a third generation of planning with this family. I started with his father, and then I started a plan with him. And his goal was to have X amount of dollars when he retired. Well, at age 65, his partners and him closed the practice. Two of them stayed on. He retired. And then he said, you know what? I'm still young enough, and I still like what I'm doing. So he found a part-time job that he worked from age 65 to age 70 and a half when he had to start taking money out of his retirement. At age 70 and a half, and he walked into my office and said, you know what? I'm willing to step down now. You know, I'm tired. I'd like to do a little bit more traveling. Two of his kids live overseas, so that was another motivation. But he worked an additional 5 years, so that was very fulfilling.
Yeah.
And when he did reach age 70 and a half, he had a lot more money to live on because he wasn't drawing it down at age 65. And I think he's had a more fulfilling life.
Absolutely. And the beauty of that story, Jim, is that he retired on his own terms. But let's just talk about the economics of that. The delay game is what we're all going to have to play. And people don't like the word wait. I know that. So we don't want to talk about waiting, but we do want to talk about delaying. And you know, for example, even with Social Security, if you delay from age 62 to 70, your benefit goes up exponentially, right? And then how about not touching those retirement savings for those 8 years? How much growth could you experience in those 8 years? I've seen studies that show, and you probably have charts that illustrate this, Jim, that if you delay your Social Security from 62 to 70 and you don't touch retirement savings, you just work in that period up till 70, the income you're going to realize at age 70, it's almost equal to having an additional $500,000 in your nest egg.
We've done this. In this particular case, he decided to allow his Social Security benefits to accrue to age 70 because it was growing at 9% a year. I mean, how many people would invest in the market if they could get a guaranteed return of 9% a year?
And that's what he's getting for delaying.
Yeah.
Here's the funny thing. I'm sure anyone who's interested in math knows what compounding wealth is. Well, when does compounding wealth have its greatest impact? In the late stage.
Absolutely.
And this is exactly when we unplug it. Just as it's about to explode and compound, we unplug it at age 62.
And see, this is one of the things that he discovered when we were looking at his plan, when he said, look, you know, I don't want to retire. I want to work part-time. He goes, I don't need my Social Security. And I said, well, the good news is if you don't touch your Social Security at age 66, which would have been his full retirement benefits, I said, the good news is it's growing at 9% a year.
Yeah.
He looked at that. And he said, 9% a year guaranteed by the government, I'll take it. And that's exactly what he did. I want to cover a final point. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal, which made me think about what you were talking about here. They had found that people that work longer live longer.
Yes.
So let's talk about what it means for health.
Yeah, well, what it means for health is that you're engaged, right? Work is good for us. I mean, this is the thing that seems to be missing in all this retirement policy, right? Work is good for us. Here's the bottom line. Let me share with you what's driving this. It's concern for health. One of the latest findings of the Dementia and Alzheimer's Institute was that they said they literally figured out what the finger in the dike was holding back the progression of both those disease states. And do you know what it was, Jim?
Work.
Maintaining intellectual challenge in your life. So this explains why people who work longer live longer. The brain is an organ. If you don't use it, you lose it. And I talk to guys all the time who go into retirement, and they're telling me, you know, guys who used to be in sales, and they're saying, within 2 months, I wasn't as lucid and articulate as I used to be. My thoughts weren't snapping together. So what people are learning to embrace here is that we have to maintain a level of challenge, both intellectually and physically and energy-wise in our lives. And if we don't, we just start going down the spiral. So that is one of the biggest factors that impacts the study of that article.
Well, let's talk about, as we close here, you are so convinced about this. You did a lot of research. You wrote a book. It's called The New Retirement Mentality. Tell our listeners about it, because I think it's a well worth a read.
Well, that's interesting, Jim. The New Retirement Mentality is in its fourth edition. And when I first wrote this book in 2001, people looked at me sideways and wondered what I was smoking, because I said everything I'm saying today, but I was saying it in 2001. Well, now the reality, I think the market correction and the Great Recession in 2008 and people sort of having to reexamine this has brought the whole world toward the conclusion that I brought in 2001, and that is that this really isn't that great an idea, retirement. And not only from a health perspective, but from an economic, both microeconomics and macroeconomics and personal economics, and from a lifestyle point of view, and from a balance in life point of view between vacation and vocation, it's not that great an idea. So the world is coming around and saying, I guess we need to rethink this thing. And so, yeah, the New Retirement Mentality, you can go online, get the book, and I'm going to tell you, it's a life changer for a lot of people, because what I challenge people to do is to think this through for themselves and to make a personal decision, not let them, the world, the institutions, the governments, and the social expectations around you tell you what to do with your life. This is your life. Invest it the way you want to.
Well, listen, Mitch, some great thoughts there, because I'm seeing it in reality with clients or incoming clients. They either didn't have the assets they thought they were going to have, and that's certainly becoming more of a reality. You're not seeing the defined benefit pension plans, the investment markets, the yields on savings aren't what they used to be. And then I'm also seeing on the other end, people are saying, you know what, I got bored with retirement. I'm doing something different. And I did this for a living throughout my adult life, but here was something I always wanted to do, and sometimes they take up different careers. So it's kind of an exciting concept. Mitch, once again, if they'd like to find out more about your book, how could they do so, please?
Just go online, The New Retire Mentality. It's the word retire with the word mentality tacked on to the end. New Retire Mentality. My name is Mitch Anthony, and then get it at any bookseller.
Well, listen, Mitch, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best to you, sir, and some great thoughts.
It's been a pleasure, Jim. Thank you so much.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income. Well worth the read. I'd highly recommend that you get a copy of this book and rethink some of the things you're doing in retirement, because he talked about some realities here that we're starting to see. We've talked about this on the show several times. Employers are getting rid of retirement defined benefit programs, and it's not going to be much longer before it goes away in government. So if you're in government today, watch out. You may see reductions in these promises because there simply isn't the money to pay for them. Secondly, you know, and here's probably the most important one, is I've interviewed experts in the health field, from Dr. Small at the UCLA Longevity Center on Alzheimer's and dementia. And the conclusions here, 75% of dementia and a lot of these diseases have a lot to do with lifestyle. And, you know, keeping your brain active, doing things are so much more positive. And I think it's becoming more of a reality as we take a look at investment returns. These are the most dismal returns I've ever seen in savings. And I've been in this business 35 years now. And so rethink retirement. You may find it refreshing to work part-time and do something. Maybe there is something you did, you know, during your working career and you said, you know, I always wanted to do something different. I had a client who retired from the publishing industry, moved to the West Coast, lived up near Hearst Castle, visited, and ended up becoming a tour guide because he loved the place and had a very, very fulfilling part-time job that he just absolutely loved. So rethink on retirement. You got to think outside the box today because we certainly live in a different environment where things are changing, whether it's on the healthcare front or on the investment front. Well, we've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.